Golf Smarter number 247, recorded on September 7, 2010.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
The future of golf course development and design with Chuck Ermish.
This is Golf Smarter. Sharing tips and insights from golfers and golf professionals to help lower your score. It's worked for your host, Fred Green.
Welcome and thanks for downloading the Golf Smarter podcast. Episode number 247 is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature that includes fiction, nonfiction, golf books, and periodicals. For a free audiobook, golf book of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/golfsmarter. Stay tuned because after today's interview, we'll announce the winner of our Mo Norman Advanced Training Kit. But that's coming up at the end of the show. And now generally at the end of the show, we close out with quotes or six words on golf. But I wanted to share this quote that Golf Smarter member Richard Todd sent me this morning from someone who is complaining about slow pace of play. Quote, "The game of golf is in a fair way of becoming unplayable in America on account of the amazing and unconscionable slowness of American players. The prevalent idea that an American is a born hustler is sadly belied on the golf links. It may be that just because he has learned to travel in express subway trains, the American has forgotten how to walk. On the golf links, he walks terribly slowly." Oh, by the way, this was written by H.J. Wigham in The Common Sense of Golf, written in 1910. Today is the first of another two-part conversation. It wasn't initially scheduled that way, but I found golf course architect Chuck Ermish so interesting that I asked him to come back on our next show as well so that I can complete my list of questions that didn't get covered in this episode. Personally, I really like to speak with course architects for a number of reasons. Most of the time, these professionals love golf as much as we do, but are not necessarily great golfers. So they understand the struggles that most golfers have to deal with. I also believe that if we understand how a course architect thinks when they're designing a course, we can bring strategic edge to our game that many players don't consider. So, let's see what we can learn here. Welcome to the Golf Smarter Podcast, Chuck.
Hey, how are you today?
I'm doing fine. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for the invite. Look forward to it.
Well, you know, it's interesting. More often than not, I like to have golf course architects on the show because of the approach that you bring to a golf course is so different than most golf instructors.
Yeah, we see things a little differently.
You really do, and it's not, you don't see it. Golf instructors to me are guys who can play golf really well, and they think, well, boy, I should just teach how to do this, and they don't necessarily know how to teach, but they know how to play golf. So it's hard for them to translate. But you see, you know, most golf course architects that I've spoken to don't claim to be really good golfers.
I'm about a 13 handicap, so my game could definitely use some improvement. But
I also found out that golf course architects don't necessarily have the time to play golf.
Well, that's very true, too. That's very true. I always say that I'm always playing 18 holes a day in my mind, no matter what. So I'm getting, you know, plenty of mental exercise. But it doesn't lend itself when you're working on several projects to be able to play. So.
And working at several projects simultaneously may be very difficult because they're not necessarily in the same geographic region, correct?
Well, yeah, they're not in the same region, and they may not even be in the same phase of the project.
Oh,
so sometimes, you know, I may be having a couple of projects on the boards where I'm actually doing the detailed design portion, and then I may have a couple of projects that are being built in the field. So, you know, ultimately that's the scenario you'd like to have so that you can keep the business moving forward.
Yeah, what is the perfect scenario for a number of projects that you have and what phases they're in?
Well, I'm a smaller firm, so what I like to do is try and work on 3 to 5 projects a year if possible, and typically have 3 that are in planning and 2 under construction so that, you know, you can keep them moving forward so that hopefully when you finish a project that's under construction, your next one's ready to go. And the challenge with that is trying to get the backlog of work. because you always want to try and have, you know, 3 to 5 to 9 projects that are maybe 2 years away, but your name's in there and you're ready to move into it so that when they're ready to pull the trigger, your workflow keeps moving.
And what is the lifespan of a project from, say, the time that you've had numerous conversations with a developer or something, and they say, okay, yes, let's sign a contract. From the time you sign the contract until the time you kind of take pictures with the owners out in front of the first tee saying, okay, we're done, let's move on to the next thing. What's the general time frame?
Well, back in the 90s, it's probably 1 to 3 years, but I would say more recently it's anywhere from 3 to 7 years.
And what changed?
Well, I think it's
the economy, obviously.
Yeah, the economy and the financing portion. It's taking them longer to get financed. So from an architecture standpoint, basically the first thing that a developer needs is he needs that pretty picture plan that he can go sell. So, you know, I do a lot of work up front, and which is good and bad, but I give him the whole concept of what his project can be. And I'm basically doing a sales job for the developers to even sell him on what his project can be. And then once he gets an understanding of, all right, this is what I can be and this is what I want to be, then he has to take that plan, go to, you know, the government entities that are involved and things like that to even get approval for the project. Then once he gets approval for the project, then he goes and starts to get the financing piece. So it's just, it takes longer for each individual process.
And what would be the project that in the 90s would have been approved and moved along quickly that you cannot get done anymore?
Oh, you know, a lot of private developers are having a lot more difficulty getting their projects through. Municipal work still goes strong because there are a lot of different funding mechanisms for municipal projects. I mean, they can pull bonds, they can do a bunch of different things, they can do TIF projects. For a private developer, it's a little more interesting because he can't necessarily walk into a bank and say, hey, I want to do a, you know, $22 million project with housing because he can't come up with the collateral. Hmm. And a lot of banks are wanting at least, you know, 40% of that down. So by the time you really start putting a pencil to it, it's like it's almost worth him going in and trying to get project started on his own without going through conventional financing. But, you know, you get to a point where that doesn't even work. So it's a harder sell.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have to believe there's a lot less being developed right now as far as golf courses, at least in the United States.
There is a lot less being developed right now. As a matter of fact, I think I read a statistic the other day that surprised me, but there were more closings last year than there were actually courses open.
Oh, that's not good.
Oh, no. And
I've heard, you know, that statistic as well, yeah.
It's just a downward trend, but it's all tied to the economy. It's all tied to, you know, developers aren't capable of getting the financing they need to get infrastructure in so that they can sell lots. And the reality of it is that golf courses are used as amenity to a developer. He doesn't look at the golf course as a business. He looks at it as, all right, what can I build that's going to help me to sell lots and sell lots for a greater value. So from any type of developer standpoint, golf is a little bit of a risky thing because they don't want to get 3 to 5 years into it and then all of a sudden realize they're in the golf course business because that's not really what they are. they want to flip lots. I mean, they develop lots and they sell homes.
Right.
So what ends up happening is they'll try to do the golf course on the cheap or they'll try and get it in as inexpensively as they can. But then they get caught 5 years later with a product that probably isn't as good as it could have been, and they can't unload it, they can't do anything with it. And that's where a lot of developers get in trouble. So what I've been working on is actually trying to say, all right, as my business, I'm going to come in, I'm going to design the course, I'm going to be there all the way through the construction of it, and I'm actually looking at becoming the golf course manager for them for the first 3 to 5 years so that they know that they've got a product that they can sell if they need to after that 5-year mark. And I don't know that a lot of other architects are doing that right now.
Hmm. What was the cause of the boom back in the 90s? Was it, again, it's just these guys wanting to develop an amenity, as you call it. I think that's a great way to term it. Or was it Tiger's, you know, rise to fame? Or what do you think made it such a great period for golf course architecture?
Well, I think golf was pretty popular, but I really think that developers looked at it as an amenity. Mm-hmm. I mean, they realized that, you know, yeah, golf's hot right now. We need something to compete with the project that's going in across the street. If we can put in a golf course and somehow, you know, sell a lot and have lot buyer put in X amount of dollars a year to the golf course, then that just adds to his lot cost. So we're making out like bandits. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that business philosophy at all. But what they forgot to do is say, well, what happens in 5 to 7 years? When the golf course starts aging and, you know, when things start happening on the golf course to where it's not as attractive as it was when it once opened, and, you know, who's actually going to play the golf course? Because when we built it, all the lot owners were very excited because they had a golf course, but then they realized they could go down the street and play a different course. So, I mean, there's just a lot of different factors that go into a business plan. And that's where, like, I think a very good architect has a lot of say. I mean, I've always said that I interview my owner at least 3 times before he even interviews me.
Wow.
Because I need to know what his business plan is. I need to know what type of product he wants me to design. I need to know who his intended user is going to be so I know how to design the product. You know, there's just a lot of things that I need answered to give him the best product for what he wants to promote. And I think a lot of people don't think about that.
Interesting. I'm going to spend a moment here. We'll come right back to this, but I just want to remind everybody here that this episode of the Golf Smarter podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature that include fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, you can go to audiblepodcast.com/golfsmarter. And for Golf Smarter listeners who do not already have an Audible account, they would like you to try out their service. Audible is offering you a free audiobook of your choice. And so I'd like to make a recommendation. There's a classic book that many people have read if they're golf fans and if they've also seen the movie. It's called The Legend of Bagger Vance. It was written by Steve Pressfield, and it's narrated by Ronnie Cox. It's only about 5 hours long, which is, you know, a good introduction to audiobooks. You can also go a lot longer if you want. There's books that are much longer, but this would be a great, great book because it's such a beautiful story that has great imagery to it. So when you have someone reading to you, you can really see a lot more of the book than you can sometimes when you're watching the movie. So check it out, The Legend of Bagger Vance by Stephen Pressfield. Again, to get the audiobook of your choice, you can choose anything you want. For your first one for free, go to audiblepodcast.com. That's A-U-D-I-B-L-E, audiblepodcast.com/golfsmarter. And we'll put a link to that URL in our show notes. So if you want to just go to our blog or check your show notes, you can have it right there and it'll remind you about it. Now let's get back to our conversation with Chuck about golf course architecture. Chuck, thank you for waiting for that.
Oh, no problem.
Okay. So in developing new products, and you're talking about other developers versus you, are there rock stars in the golf course architect world that can just come in and say, here's what I want to do? You know, you were saying you interview guys, you know, 3 times before you decide to make that leap of faith to work with them. But you may have to listen to a lot of what they say. I want this here. I want that there. I want a waterfall. I want, you know. But are there guys that come in and say, no, we're going to do it my way?
Absolutely there are. And I think a lot of it, well, the business is very ego-driven. I mean, there's no doubt about that.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I think a lot of that has come from the people who made a living in the profession of playing golf who have all of a sudden gotten into the golf course architecture business. And developers love them because that ties a household name to a product that's being built on their site. So take, you know, the Nicklauses, the Palmers, the Faldos. Those guys, I mean, they could go to any owner and just say, hey, I want to do a course for you, and the owner's really going to listen to them.
Sure, because they're already a recognized brand.
Yeah, it may not be because of their architectural experience, but they are a recognizable brand.
Right.
And basically, in talking to developers, they can add 20 to 30% onto a lot's value just because of that recognizable brand.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, makes me kind of wish that I was a professional golfer, but...
But with a 13 handicap, you're not going to be.
So... No. But, you know, what ends up happening is a lot of those guys, they played golf so much, and they played courses all over the world, and they played in all different regions of the world. They have a very good idea of what looks good.
Mm.
So they can look at a site, and they can say, man, I played this whole, you know, it's that type of style would look fabulous on this site. Well, they don't know necessarily how to design it to look that way. And that's where guys like me come in.
Okay. So have you ever had the opportunity to work with one of those rock stars?
I have. I've worked with Nick Faldo, and I've also worked with Tom Watson. And I enjoyed both of them very much.
Oh, please tell a story. Share something about working with someone like Nick Faldo.
Nick was really, he's an interesting guy. He's true Brit. So his personality, you know, it comes off that way. But I worked with Nick on a course in the middle of Kansas. It was a sand dunes course, actually. So Kansas isn't all flat like people think. There's a nice little string of sand dunes that go right up through the middle of the state. Prairie Dunes is in the middle of Kansas, and that's probably one of the most famous sand dune courses in the United States. And this site was actually like 5 minutes from Prairie Dunes. So I caught wind that the project was going to be built, and it was almost the same day that I was reading a magazine article that Aldo said, hey, I'm looking for some design work in the U.S. So I called him on a whim. And I said, you know, I have this project. You may or may not be interested. I'm an architect in Kansas City. I'm 3 hours away from the site. Would you be interested in teaming up and going after this? So 3 months later, he responded. He's like, absolutely, let's go for it. So I made the introduction of Faldo to the owner. The owner and Faldo put the deal together, and then I got in on the back end of it as construction manager and some design. So really, really a good workout system.
Oh, that's awesome. That's a great story. And do golfers like that, guys who've played on the tour and are a brand, a recognizable brand, you were saying, do they look at a course and go, this would look nice, or do they say this would play well?
You know, I think it's a combination of both. First and foremost, they're looking at it from a playability standpoint.
Okay.
They want shot value. They want, you know, to test the golfer. It's guys like me who then come in and massage it and say, well, yeah, that's great, but what about the edges? You know, not everybody hits it right down the middle of the fairway. Not everybody hits every spot on the green where the pin is. So, you know, I think there's a give and take of, all right, we understand the strategy, we understand the shot value part, but now let's make it playable to a majority of the public.
Thank you. We appreciate that.
Yeah, and sometimes that works and sometimes that doesn't. I mean, sometimes in Faldo's case, there were a couple things that we kind of butted heads on because, you know, he really, really, really wanted that shot value. And, you know, he wasn't about to soften it in any way, shape, or form. And at the end of the day, his name on the project, so that's the way it ended up. So, a very difficult course we built, actually.
Oh, really? So you didn't get to soften up the edges?
We softened some, but it turned out to be a pretty difficult course. Plus, you throw in a 30-mile-an-hour wind in the middle of Kansas, so there you go.
And it's all around sand dunes. So do you have thousands, like Whistling Straits, which we witnessed earlier this year in the PGA Championship, where you have thousands of bunkers everywhere? You know, the joke was, if it's sand, it's a bunker, even if it's just under your foot.
Right.
Did you have a situation like that everything was just bunkers, bunkers, bunkers?
Yeah, it wasn't so much bunker. It was just that we didn't plant any turf on it. So, you know, it would be just the native, you know, blue stem and stuff like that that was growing up through the sand. It was just an unmaintained area. It was a sand base, unmaintained area. So, and when we're talking sand dunes, we're talking some of them were 30 feet drops into areas that didn't drain to anything that would come back up. But I mean, true sand dunes. Wow. And when you get out on this course in Kansas, you do not feel like you're in Kansas. I mean, you would literally swear you were by the seaside.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Awesome.
So, yeah, I mean, just an incredible sight. And it's just unfortunate that it's, you know, 3 hours from any main population area.
Right.
So, I don't, you know, they don't get a lot of play.
And it's not necessarily a destination area except for golfers.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
So,
and what would be the hardest thing on a course like that? Would, I guess, just from a layman's perspective, I would think that having good greens may be the most difficult element to keep going, right?
Well, the greens definitely are. But greens are such engineered... let's get into the engineering of a golf green, if you don't mind.
Oh, so please.
So the listeners have a better understanding. There's basically two types of greens. There's push-up greens, which are made out of the native soil. And then there's the USGA spec greens, which you actually have to create, where you go in and you do a drainage layer underneath and a gravel layer, and then you bring in an imported root zone mix to help keep the green healthy. Okay? Mm-hmm. So if you have a natural sand site, you really don't need the drainage underneath because it drains so well. So, like the greens on the Faldo course, we really didn't do much to them. We brought in a material to put in to implement into the sand for nutrient value. But as far as the shaping and things like that, I mean, it was really basically bring in a dozer and push some things around. But, you know, it wasn't the full-fledged USGA greens that we all think of. So in that case, you know, it worked out okay. And you get on some sites that are like in the mountains or in the rocks or wherever like that, where they just don't have drainage. Then it's an engineered process.
I see. And how do you incorporate strategy for the average player into your designs?
Well, I use my playing knowledge and knowledge that I picked up from Tom Watson and from Nick Faldo. But really, when I look at a design, I'm not even necessarily thinking about play as far as shot value. I'm more looking at it from, okay, you've got a golf course as part of an overall project. So you have housing and you have all these things that are going on around the golf course. You have infrastructure for the housing, such as sewer, water, things like that that have to be built into the plan. So a lot of times that gets put in through the golf course. So when I'm looking at a golf course, I'm looking at stormwater drainage, and I'm looking at utilities, and I'm looking at all kinds of things that actually have to be incorporated into it. And then hopefully I can balance all those things out and still make a very eye-appealing golf hole that is fair to play. So it's a big jigsaw puzzle. That's exactly what it ends up being. And I have a rule that I like to call the 3Ds of golf design.
The three Ds of golf design?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. And it's basically drainage. And it's moving water, storm water, from point A to point B, and how effectively you can do that. And you use the features of the golf course to do that. So, like, you build mounds on the sides of the fairways, not so much to build mounds, but those mounds help divert water to where you need the water to go to.
So your biggest enemy is standing water.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So what ends up happening is, like the 3Ds that I was talking about, we have water that comes on the site from surrounding sites. We have to deal with that. We have to know where that water enters our site. Then we have water that we are going to generate on our site with the golf course. We have to manage that. And then we have water that leaves our site that we have to manage. So it all comes down to this basic hydrology study of, all right, how do I get water from point A to point B? How do I keep it the same flow so that we're not dumping a million more gallons a day onto our neighbors? And how are we managing the water that's coming in to us from other people? So, like when you go to a golf course, that's why they have the ponding, they have the streams, they have all these things. It's not necessarily because they felt like, oh, I want to put a pond there. It's because that pond is actually helping to manage the stormwater.
Interesting.
So it's a little more technical than I think a lot of people really think.
Right. No, to golfers, it's either visual appeal or torture.
Right. The whole object is, though, to take that visual appeal, or how should I put this? To take the technical aspect of what we deal with as an architect and give it a very visual appeal. That's when you know you have a good project.
Right. Or a visual appeal or a visual distraction, right?
Yeah.
That's where I'm talking about the strategy of it, is that, you know, you'll see frequently on a par three, there's going to be water between you and the green. And I think that is supposed to be something that, at least that, from my perspective, it's something that gets in the head of the golfer, that they put that there on purpose to take a 160-yard shot, which from any fairway, that's not a difficult shot. But all of a sudden with water there, you start thinking about it differently, your approach to it as a golfer.
Well, absolutely, and that adds to the game. That adds to the aspect of the playability of it. But from an architect standpoint, I think sometimes we're even thinking, well, wait a minute, no, I'm really thinking of that pond as something that's where a lot of the water is flowing to that we're trying to, you know, control. And, you know, wow, it would be kind of cool to have a hole play across it. We don't know if it's going to be a par three or a par four, but let's bring that feature into play. I mean, if we have to deal with the water, then let's bring it into play.
Mm-hmm.
So then it just becomes, you know, what's the best shot value related to what we're trying to do from a very scientific standpoint, or from a very technical standpoint.
There's a large green movement going on in the world today. How is that impacting your work?
From an architecture standpoint, a little bit, but it's more from a maintenance aspect. And to be honest with you, if we're not looking at the maintenance aspect from a design standpoint, we're probably doing a disservice. So As an architect, we're a little bit behind, I think, the eight ball as far as understanding the green movement. People a lot of times think we're the ones who are pushing it, but we're not necessarily pushing it. We're more in a opportunity to respond to it and then build on it. So, you know, the guys who maintain course every day know a heck of a lot more about the green movement than probably I do.
Oh, that's interesting. And I would think that once your job is done and they open the golf course for business, the single greatest line item in their budgets is maintenance, right?
Yeah.
That'll bury a course, I would think, that not being able to maintain the course.
It could. But see, back to one of the statements that I made in the beginning of our conversation, I'm actually trying to get more involved in the first 3 to 5 years of the operations of the course. Because in my mind, I know what that golf course is envisioned to be, and I know every fairway line, I know every tee box, I know every, I mean, that's, in my mind, I've designed it to that detail. And typically what has happened before is architects will get to the point where it's like, okay, here's your key, owner, and they walk away. Well, owner sits there and has 2 years of grow-in and has all these things that has to happen to get his course up and running. You really think that's a priority for the owner? Probably not, because he's lost. He doesn't have the knowledge to be able to do that. So what happens is he just spent $5 to $7 million for a design and a golf course, and when you hand the keys over, he's already depreciated that thing to a $3 million value because he's already taken shortcuts on how to maintain it. Hmm. And what, you know, it just trickles downhill. That's why, you know, golf courses are always the prettiest the day they open. Well, of course, because the architect's design is intact and everything is there. then the first 3 years, when they start running into budget crunches, they start taking shortcuts. Well, we can narrow the fairway here. Well, we can bring in native grass here. Well, we can do this. Well, we can do that to help our maintenance costs. Yes, you can, but are you affecting the integrity of the course the way it was designed for the purpose of which it was designed? And I said a lot in that sentence, but the way I look at a golf course being designed is I have to know who the ultimate user is and what their expectations are.
And how do you define that?
Talking to the owner.
But is that the ultimate user? Is the owner the one that really is the determining factor, or is it the weekend player?
No, but the owner has a business plan. The owner has a business plan that says, you know what, I want to sell $200,000 homes, $250,000 homes, or I'm a championship golf course. Well, if 3 years into it, all of a sudden his championship golf course has become a muni where he's letting people run around in cut-off shorts and T-shirts, and it's not maintained to a championship golf course, what happened to those people who invested and built $250,000, $300,000 houses? They're not very happy.
No, wait, you're talking to somebody who lives in Northern California, so finding a house for $200,000 would be absolutely amazing. That's that is like a tear-down 1,000-square-foot shack where
it's
I live.
All relative. It
does, yeah, right. So when you say a $200,000
okay.
home, you're talking about a 4,000.
In California terms, let's say 950 to 1 million.
Okay, so you're talking about a 2,500 to 3,000 square foot home.
Yes.
Okay, that's new.
Yes.
Okay. You would.
See, in Kansas, we can still build very nice houses and live in very nice houses.
That's
for,
yeah.
You know,
that's $1.5 million.
$350,000, $600,000, whatever.
Yeah, In the San Francisco area, if you're in the immediate San Francisco area in the counties here, that house could easily cost you a new one for 3,000 square feet could easily cost you $1.5 million.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah, we're whacked here.
But see, this is where it gets back to. Okay. Owner's expectations. What does the owner want to project? You know, and an owner can easily blow that in the first 3 years of the existence of the golf course if he is not very careful. Because he's getting into a business that he really doesn't know a lot about. That's why I think I think there's some really good golf management companies out there that all they do is manage golf courses.
Right.
And I think those are good relationships for an owner to get into. But, you know, I'm sitting here thinking to myself, who knows the course better than the architect?
Yeah,
you know,
probably
who,
right.
Who knows the vision more than the guy who actually dreamt up the vision? And you know, I've had many battles with owners of saying, you know, because they come to me when we're in construction, and they're saying, well, do we really need that wall because that'd cut $20,000 off my budget? Well, yes, you really need that wall. Because that's part of the character of the course that we discussed that you said that you wanted. Well, I don't want that now. Well, then you're sacrificing the integrity of the course that you said that you wanted. Are you sure you want to do that?
Well, there's many topics here that I've written down that we've not had a chance to go over. I'd like to talk about overseas development and what's going on with there, what kind of responses that your industry is taking to golf course closings like that. Could we do another episode for next week?
Absolutely.
Awesome. So what we're going to do is the audience will think that this is going to be two episodes in two separate weeks, but we're just going to go ahead and say goodbye for now, and then we'll start recording in another minute. Is that okay with you?
Yeah, that's fine.
All right, so you'll be back next week?
I'll be back next week.
Well, okay, so next week for me, for you, whatever it means. But we did record another episode, and that will be on our Golf Smarter for Members Only next week. What I find interesting about talking to Chuck is that he's in Shawnee, Kansas. And me being here in Northern California, we have really different perspective on not only the socio, but the economic environments that surround us. So I just... That's part of what I love talking about him. Thanks again for everyone who entered our drawing for the Mo Norman Advanced Training Kit. And thank you again to Todd Graves for his generous support and contribution. Again, we urge you to check out MoNormanGolf.com and listen to episode number 243 to hear Todd speak authoritatively about the single plane swing as developed by Mo Norman. Congratulations to Scott Seaman of Park City, Utah. His name was randomly selected and is our winner of this month's prize package valued at nearly $400. Do you remember our two-part conversation with John Novosel, creator of the Tour Tempo Microplayer back in August of 2009? And just over a year ago, those were episodes number 191 and 192. 192 being a members-only episode. Well, I'm still a big fan of this training aid because it really addresses what may be the missing fundamental in golf, and that is swing tempo. Well, it's time to give one away. We're going to give away a new Tour Tempo Microplayer to Golf Smarter listener. To enter, please go to golfsmarter.com and click on the tab labeled Contest. Deadline for entry is October 1st, 2010. That's 10-01-10. Of course, we close with Six Words on Golf, this one submitted by Anthony Etherton. They should make the holes bigger! Next week for Members Only, Part 2 with course architect Chuck Aramish. To hear the entire episode, join Golf Smarter for Members Only. If you have any questions, comments, suggestions, or want to share your Six Words on Golf, please click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.